Hi, everyone. This is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spirituals podcast on the Be Here Now Network. And my guest today is Paul Thorstensen. Paul, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely.
So I'm guessing many, if not almost all of my listeners are not familiar with Paul, though actually I shouldn't say that. I do have a lot of friends that are punks, old school hardcore, that are into meditation and Buddhism, or just not, and like this podcast. So some of you might know Paul, but if you are familiar with punk and hardcore, then you probably do. That said, let me tell you a little bit about Paul before we jump into this conversation. Paul Thorstensen has been toiling in relative obscurity since 1991 as the vocalist for metallic hardcore band Dissolve. In addition to Dissolve, Paul has been the vocalist for Devil May Care, Withdrawn, Through Blood Reborn, Sensory Deception, Occult Knife, Secret Fangs, and a bunch of other projects. Paul's vocals consist mostly of yelling and screaming, and his voice has been compared to a pig in pain and a chihuahua being run over by a lawnmower. Over the years, he has incorporated synthesizers, noise, sound effects, and vocal treatment to his MO with mixed results. Paul's lyrics make more sense to other people than they do to him. In his spare time, Paul raises his two kids with his wife in Poughkeepsie, New York, and also has a job. So, Paul, thank you again, man. That's probably one of my favorite bios I've gotten to read of any of my guests. So thanks for providing us with a fun start to this conversation.
Oh, yeah, no problem. No problem. It's really very hard to, you know, talk about yourself. So,
yeah. So fortunately for me, when my first book came out, like, I had help writing the bio because I hate talking about myself, though. That is the line of work I've kind of fallen into, oddly enough. But yeah, I just actually had to recently change my bio because it sounded way too like formal. And I'm like, that's not me. So, but even changing it in a playful way, it's more of a self kind of deprecating bio now, but it's more truthful to who I am. So I hear you. Like when I get introduced on interviews or at workshops or wherever, I always feel so weird because it sounds like, you know, I'm this accomplished person. And then it's like, you know, right now I'm looking around my apartment and dude, if you walked in here, you would never in a million years guess that there's a quote unquote spiritual author or, you know, teacher that lives here. Cause it looks like fucking, it's a mix of, you know, hardcore flyers and, you know, horror movie posters and horror figures and toys and skateboards. And I'm a big kid. So anyways, did I just say I don't like to talk about myself? So Paul, let's for listeners, I, you know, Dissolve is the way I found my way to you. I have been a fan since as far back as I can remember. Before we get into that part of how I came to know you, the way I typically like to start my show is have our guests tell us a bit about themselves and what led them to where they are today. I leave that up to you, whether you want to talk a little bit starting about your childhood into teenage years or, you know, whatever you're comfortable with, when you found music, what pulled you to music, what pulled you to hardcore, really whatever direction you want to go with that. And then from there, we'll talk about Dissolve and all sorts of other fun stuff.
Sure. Sounds good. Well, I was raised by a couple of fairly artistic people. My father is a musician. He's a guitar player. Mm-hmm. My mother. My mother was a photographer and oil painter. Well, you know, really just a lot of different mediums that she worked in. So I guess I was always kind of around, you know, the artsy-fartsy lifestyle. So, I guess when I got older, I discovered heavy music probably when I was about 11 or 12. There was a guy that moved up from Florida that turned me on to Iron Maiden and Ronnie James Dio and, you know, the gods.
The gods, right, yeah.
Yeah, and then I also, like, it's funny, but really right around the same time I discovered rap music.
Yes.
Because there was a guy, I didn't even know who he was. I still don't know who he is. I never introduced myself to him. But back when I was really young, People used to bring boom boxes to school and play music on the bus. Now everybody has headphones and they all listen to their own music. It's kind of too bad because I got turned on to a lot of interesting stuff because of people bringing boom boxes onto the bus. And one of the things was rap music, where there was this guy, I was living out in cow country, and this guy was a transplant, obviously.
Right.
I mean, I don't know the guy, but he was obviously a transplant from somewhere much more urban. Like, you know, he had, you know, the custom made shirts with the iron on Playboy bunnies and stuff like that. Okay. Like he's a B-boy.
Yeah.
You know? So, I heard that music at the same time, and it wasn't really for a few years later that I heard hardcore.
Yeah.
I think when I was about 15, I discovered that. And that was because this guy that I knew in school who I was friends with, and it was kind of an unlikely friendship. He was kind of like a jock guy. I think he was on the football team, soccer team, but for some reason he liked me, you know. We were in classes together, and one day he showed up to school with, like, you know, his head shaved and he had combat boots on, and he, you know, he's totally different person than he was the day before. And he's like, I'm into hardcore punk now, man. You know, so he had this mixtape that he borrowed from probably the only punk rock person in the school. This girl, I remember Samantha, I had a big crush on her, but that's a whole other thing. but he let me borrow the tape. I never gave it back. It had the Angry Samoans, Black Flag, Minor Threat. The very first song on it was Rise Above from Black Flag. TV Party was the second one. I Don't Want to Hear It from Minor Threat, and the song Minor Threat. And I think those four songs I just listened to over and over and over and over and over again. And it was, you know, it's corny, but it was life changing, you know.
Yeah, hell yeah.
But yeah, and that's really kind of how I got into hardcore. A couple of years later, like I said, I lived in a very rural area, and it was the mid 80s.
Yep.
So there, I wasn't really aware of what was going on. There was really no way of knowing about shows unless you were already kind of in the scene. You know, you had to find it, or it had to find you.
Yes.
You know? And it did eventually. And I started going to shows in Connecticut at the Anthrax in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And
I'm jealous.
That was, that was an amazing place. Yeah, that was in a really amazing place. I wish I had a little bit more time. I started going there in late 1988, and I went there until it closed in 1990. I went to as many shows as I could, but I really wish I had a little more time. But I also understand how lucky I am to have had that experience at all. So I try not to be too hard on myself, that's for sure. But but that kind of led to seeing shows there. I saw a lot of really great ones. I think one show in particular that was very significant to me was it was actually Shelter's very first show.
Yep.
And one of the opening bands was Inside Out.
Oh, you were at the Inside Out show at the Anthrax.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Wow.
And that was like that. I think I liked hardcore because, you know, I was your basic angsty kid. I mean, you know, in the 80s, it was the time of divorce. Everybody's parents were getting divorced in the 80s.
Right.
That was the thing. I feel like just really a generation before and a generation after, people were more willing to work things out if they could. But in the 80s, it's like, hey, let's get divorced. Woo. You know, so not to say that that's exactly what happened with my parents, but it just seemed to be a widespread problem. You know, there was I grew up, all of my friends were, children of divorce, so there were a lot of other factors. I wasn't a really popular guy in school. I didn't really fit in. I never really jived with sports or anything like that. So, you know, when you hear something angry, you know, and it's saying, you know, a message like the song, like the actual song Minor Threat from Minor Threat, you're just like, holy shit, man, this is the anger I feel. These are the frustrations I have, you know?
Yeah.
And I think really up until I saw that Inside Out show, I think Inside Out, seeing that, opened things up in a much different way for me, because here was a band, their message was actually very positive. And the way that it all made me feel, musically and lyrically and vocally, like all of it happening all at once, and the way that they presented themselves on stage, it was something that you could feel. Like it was, and yes. it wasn't a tangible thing. And it's, I think what it is its soul. There was soul in it.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like what it must have felt like to see Otis Redding live,
right,
or something, you know, like,
yeah,
like something where it's just like, you just, it fills you. It fills yeah. you with this kind of intangible energy. And I think that was really kind of, that was a real turning point. And I think really it was like, I remember on the ride home thinking to myself, I got to be in a band. I got to do that.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what I got to do. Like, I want to be able to do that for other people and to have that kind of experience with other people, that uplifting thing. And I realized that hardcore didn't really have to be about something negative all the time. It could be something that even if your content is negative, because, you know, if you read the Zov lyrics, they're not really, you know, up with people.
Sure.
Happy go lucky stuff. But there's a feeling when you play it live, there's an energy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what I wanted to be a part of. And not all heavy music and hardcore has it.
Right.
You know,
agreed.
But that's the stuff that speaks to me. Like, if it has that thing I can't define, that makes me feel really alive.
Yeah.
You know, you feel it tingle all through your body. And you get so excited, like you're levitating listening to it.
Yeah.
And I think there's an opportunity in hardcore for that. There really is. And it's a missed opportunity a lot, you know.
It truly is.
Yeah.
It's funny because what you're saying, and I've talked about this as well, you know, my first book and in interviews, what you just said is verbatim almost my story, except, you know, I was a few years after you. But whereas I just missed the Anthrax, I got to go to the Boiler Room, and that was one of the rare Connecticut venues that wasn't there for that long. That was my first show. And then my home away from home was essentially, there was the Tune In, which you know all too well, and we'll talk about that. And there was also Studio 158. And then there are other clubs like Maxaluna's and Hanover House. Mm-hmm. But the two like go-tos were, and it was funny, it was either you were a Studio 158 guy or you were a Tune In guy. And Tune In was like a little heavier, and the Studio 158 was more experimental, though they had heavy, like they had Bloodlet, they had Dead Guy. I don't recall if Dissolve ever played there. Anyways, my, you know, just to kind of resonate with you, my introduction was, I think, 93, so a little bit after you. But I remember I was way into alternative music. I grew up as an athlete, gave that up, loved skateboarding, still skateboard to this day. Went to, my brother was still playing soccer, he's 2 years younger than me. I went to one of his games, and one of his teammates' older brother, who was a couple of years older than me and went to another school, was there. And I was wearing a Primus t-shirt, and he ends up chatting to me, and he goes, "Yo, you ever heard of this band or that band?" And he's talking about bands like Big Mistake and some other, you know, they weren't hardcore, but bands like that. And I'm like, "No, not really." He's like, "You should come check out a show with me sometime." And I'm like, "What's a show?" You know, I only knew what concerts were.
Concerts, yeah. Right, right.
But so, yeah, so like I go to his house, and because we grew up in this town called East Haddam, Connecticut, very rural, middle of nowhere, nothing to do. Luckily, he had his license. I didn't have my license yet. And I remember the first thing I think he put on for me was the Groundwork 12-inch, you know, the Groundwork. I know there were two of them, but the Bloodlink Records Groundwork. And
Not the Connecticut one.
No. The one just like it starts out with that sample and comes in. And so when you talk about Visceral, I was like, oh my God. You know, I went to my first show at the Boiler Room, and then that shortly closed out. And so he and I started a band. It was a terrible band called Claremont. But for some reason Vic, the drummer of Cable, loved us, and he booked shows at 158. And oddly enough, so did Jamie from Hatebreed. Vic and Jamie were the main dudes booking shows there. So we got to play with like a lot of great bands as a shitty band. Like I remember this band Frail. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but like,
I remember Frail.
Yeah, they were amazing. Like very passionate, and I love that. And So, you know, we broke up. He went on to join Cable and has been in Cable ever since. And good for him. They just put out a record this year that's absolutely amazing. Their first
record.
Yeah, I
have to check that out. You had recommended that to me. I have to check that out. I used to really like those guys.
Yeah, they're great, man. I highly do. It's first record in 10 years. But all that to say, it was similar. Like, so my high school friends were like, you know, hanging out, getting high, and nothing wrong with that. But like, they were going to school dances, whereas on weekends, I'm going like to shows, or I'm playing shows around New England, playing up at this space in Worcester, you know, visiting all these different areas, becoming friends with Steve Austin from Today is a Day and recording with him. And, you know, so it was just crazy. Like how, like you said, it finds you if it's,
yeah.
And I also appreciate you mentioned hip hop, because there we were like skateboarding. But it wasn't just a hardcore still listening to metal, but it was like Gangstar and Souls of Mischief and Mobb Deep and Dell and, you know, all this like great stuff, and all stuff I still listen to. And that's what I loved about the 90s, you know, was this just for me, my golden era of music. So all that to say, I want to lead up to 93. And this is where I see Dissolve for the first time at the Tune-In. And the running joke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the running joke my brother and I always like make is like, we would see you guys with Overcast like every other weekend. Obviously, it wasn't every other weekend, but it seemed like Dissolve and Overcast played at the Tune-In all the time. And whenever you guys played, we would always make the trip down. You know, Dissolve and Overcast to this day, still two of my all-time favorite bands. And I've always been a sucker for, when it comes to the heavier stuff, stuff like that, or Bloodlet, Dead Guy, Neurosis, that kind of stuff, Dillinger. But I, you know, I love Drive Like Jehu and Jawbox and just all over the place, like I know you are.
Yeah.
But so, I'm at the Tune-In. You guys take the stage. First thing I remember thinking is, this Charlie Sheen-looking motherfucker. Like, all right, let's see what he's got. And you guys blew me away. I already was familiar with Overcast and was in love with them. But your set was amazing. Your stage presence was awesome. Like, I was a huge fan. So I bought the Demo 93, which I think I sent you or tagged you in a picture. I still have to this day.
Wow.
Yeah, prized possession. I don't know where the case is, but I have the cassette. And I know, like, your lyrics, like you say in your bio, the lyrics make sense to other people than they do to yourself. But when you played Wire, and I know that that's a song that you've had a love-hate relationship with, because I've seen you play it and love it. I've seen you play it begrudgingly at reunion shows, and I get it. I'm a musician. You get over songs sometimes.
Right.
But being a, you know, a teen in 93 and hearing the lyrics like about women's rights and like your stance and like that really meant something to me. And that was part of why I fell in love with Dissolve, was, you know, like, wow, man, like I hadn't heard a song where, one, it's this brutal, but two, it's like, you know, talking about women and rights and, you know, mother, daughter, sister, wife, 50% of the ones I love, like, beautiful. So, you know, I don't know where I'm going with this. That's just like my initial Dissolve experience. And I don't think I even introduced myself. I just remember I was floored. So can you tell me a little bit about the Dissolve's beginning? You know, when you guys formed as a band, what did you have a vision? Did you have a sonic like idea? Because you guys fit into different genres, but you then and now still have your own sound. When you hear Dissolve, you know it's Dissolve. There's no mistaking it. So can you tell me about like the formation and yeah, like the vision? What was that? What's the story there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it started with John and I, the original guitar player, John Mazurowski. We lived together and we started writing songs, just kind of joking around songs, really, and had this idea of being in a band. We were really... at the time, we were really into, I think you could break it down like this. Either it was Earache Records,
where, yep,
you know, Napalm Death, Carcass, Godflesh.
I hate God.
Or that was a little bit later. This was that we got into them.
Okay.
Or it was like a lot of the ABC No Rio, New York hardcore bands, like Born Against, Citizens Arrest.
100%.
Or Rollins Band. Like, that was pretty much it. That was like our holy trinity of sound, because Rollins Band is its own thing.
Yes.
You know, and so we were really, and we're, I think what we really wanted to do was something really kind of, you know, heavy and brutal. So we got a drum machine and we actually started writing and recording songs. I wish the tape still exists because it would be hilarious. But we had three songs that we recorded with a drum machine, and John actually was pretty good at programming beats. It was a very primitive drum machine. And I think we got about three songs deep, and then John said, fuck this, let's just get a drummer. And we knew our first drummer, Kevin Rivers. We knew he was a drummer. We hadn't heard him play, but we didn't really know anybody else. So we asked him to join, and then John asked his brother Jamie to join. And I knew our first bass player, Mike Albrecht. He was a childhood friend of mine, and we all kind of everybody agreed to do it. You know, like we didn't really. It's kind of funny, you know, when you start a band that way, because none of us, except for, I mean, I had heard John play, you know, but none of us had heard each other. We didn't know what our skill level was. It wasn't or anything, or what we were going to do, or what each other's influences were. It was like, we're just going to start this band.
Yeah.
And so it could have either been awful or it was pretty much just destined to be awful, really, from the beginning. You know? But so we got together and played. And I think the first it was a really long time ago now. This is I guess about 28, almost 29 years ago. We got together for a practice, and I think the first thing we did was start writing. John had a couple of riffs, and we started playing. And by the end of the practice, we had the kind of like the skeleton of a song. It's on the 93 demo, Reincarnation.
Yeah,
that was the first thing, and it was just enough for us to be like, okay, I heard you play guitar. You can do it. You can play bass. And then I managed to like squeeze out like a little bit of vocals at the end where I was just like feverishly writing shit down, you know, while they were working. And they were like, okay, good. You don't sound terrible, you know? So we got together a couple more times. We got that song down, and we got that song down really good. And then we came to the next practice and we played that song again. And we were so happy with ourselves. We had a song that we just kind of forgot to write anything else. And, you know, I think it went on for a couple of months, and just because we were trying to write more riffs and trying to make that Reincarnation thing happen again, which I understand that's a little bit of a pun, but, but they, it just wasn't happening. Nothing was jiving, you know. It was like we'd have these riffs, nothing was working, and I kind of felt like we were kind of starting to drift apart. It was like I think by the time that was in like June we started, and I think by the time we got to like September, like we weren't, you know, like, let's not practice this week, let's not practice, or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And our idiot bass player Mike booked a show where he got us like on a show, and we were so pissed at him because we had one song, you know, and we were kind of like probably going to split up, you know? So, you know, we were really mad at him, but at the same time, we were like, well, at the same time, it might be kind of fun. So we very quickly got a bunch of covers down and we played the show. I think we had like two practices before we played the show to get a bunch of covers down, and we played the show, and there were a lot of people there. It was a lot of high school kids, because Mike went to high school at the time, and he got everybody to come, and it was like this packed bar, you know?
Yeah.
And we started playing, and people were into it, and we were having a good time. And the last song we played was Reincarnation, and the place just went crazy. And we were like, holy shit. And it was like that thing. And I kind of feel like I've been chasing that feeling ever since, like that feeling of something that, you know, you made that really brought the house down. You know, everyone started going crazy, and that just burst of energy that was going on. It was just so incredible, you know, to have that kind of connection. It was everything I hoped it would be. And you know, the crazy thing is after that, like, creativity was not a problem. Like, we all felt so energized by that. We just started writing songs, and got more and more songs, built up our set. I mean, I think in only like a couple of months, we got ourselves up to like four or five songs, and you know, started kind of getting better and better because we were, you know, I mean, I'm making it sound like, you know, it was like, it was great. We brought the house down and everything, but we were still pretty bad. You know, I mean, we were new.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
I don't know. I haven't heard a recording of what we sound like, but I'm sure it was bad. But, you know, so I think by the time that we got to late 92 and we had all of those songs and when we recorded that 93 demo, which I think we did in early 93, like maybe January or something. Yeah. Jamie would probably know better, but we were actually, that was a pretty crazy moment for us. Like just playing that back and listening to it. And actually I remember listening to it in a van with a bunch of friends, like playing it for them right after we finished it.
Yeah.
These are people who have been coming to our shitty little shows or whatever.
Sure.
And they were shocked. They couldn't believe it was us, you know,
yeah.
Like we come so far, you know, but
I just, I just want to interject really quick, yeah. Paul, about that demo.
Sure.
Back in 93, like in that era, a lot of, you know, everyone was releasing demos. This was the era of the cassette, you know, 7 inches too, but cassettes were huge. Often,
right.
And it wasn't about the quality at that point for most people. It was like, is the music there? Is the passion there?
Right.
At least for me. But the one thing that floored me, and to this day, man, I still feel like that demo holds up. I still listen to it, and the quality, yes, of course it could be better, and most recordings can, but for a
right.
demo for 93, that thing just sounds literally like monstrous, like the tones, like it's like a beast. So I just wanted to throw that out there that because there were plenty of great bands that put out shitty demos, good musically,
right.
Sonically just did not sound good. Yours musically was great and sonically sounded monstrously in the best possible way. So sorry to interrupt, but I just
wanted
to add that in there.
Well, it's funny that you should say that because we were kind of like, we made a conscious effort to not really book shows in Connecticut or in the city or anywhere out of our area until we felt we were ready.
Yeah.
Because we kind of knew we weren't that great. We were just starting out and, but I remember we played a show and my oldest friend, Howie, he and I that were really kind of got into hardcore together, went to shows together when we were young. I remember he came to one of our shows and it was in like 93, early 93. And he said, he was like, you're ready to play in Connecticut now. I was like, okay, you know.
Well, I never knew Connecticut had that kind of reputation.
Well, it's not that it had that kind of reputation. Connecticut meant a lot to me. Like,
yeah.
I always kind of looked at myself as kind of like, I identified the most as like a Connecticut hardcore person because
yeah.
that's where I started really going to shows. You
sure.
know, I wasn't a CBGB's guy. I wasn't, because it was easier to get to Norwalk from where I lived.
Right.
You know, I lived very close to Route 84. So
okay.
just,
yeah,
it was easy for us. It was easier for us to go to shows there. Not that we didn't go to the city. We went to plenty of shows in the city, but primarily we were into the Connecticut scene and I had, you know, a couple of friends there. It's funny, but a lot of the 80s guys kind of stopped going to shows by the time we started playing shows. A real notable one that was still around, that I was friends with was, Ian from Dismay, Ian Keeler.
Oh yeah, of course.
You know, and he was like an early, champion for us too. Cause
yeah.
his band was a pretty big deal at the time.
Absolutely.
In Connecticut.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was actually a big deal for me that we were good when we played there.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to make sure because I was like, oh shit, I don't want to suck there. That's the real scene, dude.
It's funny because that's what I felt about like New York,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's the big show.
Yeah, right. Oh, Connecticut. I've never, ever heard that before. So anyways.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe it's not true. Maybe it is. But that's the way it felt for me
yeah.
because that was like my home, a home away from home as far as hardcore goes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the time you saw us in 1993, we were ready for you to see us, you know, we were
yeah.
like, all right, you know, we had our good demo. We sounded good, you know, so, we kind of gotten all of our bad, instincts out, you know, but we were still learning too. I mean, it's funny, for a long time, I didn't really like that demo, because I thought that we got you know, we progressed, you know, past that sound.
Sure.
But I listen to it now and I'm like, oh, wow. You know, I mean, when I consider how young we all were,
right.
You know, I'm like, all right, I see the merit there. I do.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like you were saying before about the demo was just as valid back then as a record. I mean,
yeah.
you had your demo and then you came out with your 7-inch and then you came out with your full length. And that's
right.
just kind of how it worked. That was like how that was the timeline. And your demo, you know, I remember feeling like really gypped when bands came out with their full length record and it was just their demo.
Yeah.
You know, re-recorded, you know, I absolutely worship Killing Time and Raw Deal,
yes.
but I can't stand that fucking album because it's the fucking demo.
Right.
It's just like two new songs.
Yes.
You know, I remember when that came out being like, you know, fuck you, dude, you're not going to get my money again. And,
right.
But they did. You know, I mean, of course I bought it. I have it. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah. But,
I was just going to say, like, then you had bands where I did respect because, you know, you had those songs that were on the demos that a lot of people didn't have.
Right.
Two cases come to mind, like Cast Iron Hike. Love them. They got signed to Victory.
Right.
Had, I think, at least two songs off the, I think Trustkill did their 7-inch. I could be wrong on that. But, you know, that was a great 4-song album. And then, of course, Hatebreed, when they got signed to Victory, added a couple old. But at least, you know, there were only a couple. And the rest of it was new. So that's one thing. But yes, I agree with what you're saying. That's, yeah, you feel like, come on, man, give us some new material.
But now it's like if somebody has a demo, it really is a demo. It's
right.
really just they're putting it out in the meantime until they have something bigger. It's usually just like two or three songs. And
right.
that's a little more like it. Whereas with us, I mean, our demo was like a full length album, you know.
Yeah.
So by the time we got around to recording an album years later, you know, we only did like one song off of that. And now I think that was a bit of a misstep because, you know, I mean, that Dismantle record, I think it's only like 25 minutes long. I mean, we could have just thrown. I mean, I don't know why we didn't do Wire. I mean, it's just weird to me. Like,
yeah.
I don't know the decisions you make when you're young and, you know, stoned and stupid. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, people still go, like, you know, you play Sandblaster and people go nuts. But
right.
like Wire still after everything seems to be that song that fucking, you know, people just go insane for. Maybe I'm, you know, it was on the Over the Edge comp. Maybe that had something to do with it. But
I think it did. I think it did have a lot to do with it. That Over the Edge comp helped a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. The other thing about that song is how unbelievably hit or miss it is live, because there was we'll play it and people will be, you know, literally hanging from the rafters.
Yes.
You know, just going completely crazy.
Yes.
You know,
I have actual pictures of that happening. So, yes.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And then there's other times where we're like, all right, here's our secret weapon, and we'll play Wire and it'll be like nothing.
Wow. See, I've never
you know,
seen
yeah.
that. I've never
so
seen
we're always a little weird about it. We actually honestly, the way we play it now, it's always there.
Yeah.
And but it's never in the set list. So
yep.
if people I think the last time we played it was at that Cherry Street show.
Yep.
And the reason why we play it was because before we played, like about three people asked us if we could play it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And we all talked. We're like, well, we're going to do Wire. It's worthwhile to do it. Cause it's not that we hate, well, there was a period of time that we really were kind of tired of playing that song. And I think it's really the reason why we were tired of it wasn't really because we didn't like it. It was just that our newer songs that we liked more weren't getting the same kind of attention. So we were feeling like a little bit like, well, you know, kind of, you know, but like hurt a little bit, you
sure.
know, it's like, you know, come on. That's a couple of years old. We got this new Gabriel
yeah.
French thing, you know, I mean, it's kind of cool, you
yeah,
know, but
very cool. Yeah.
But I think now we've kind of made our peace with it, definitely, and we enjoy playing it because we love the reaction it gets. And we understand, I think when you get older, you understand that there are things you hear when you're young
yeah.
and before you're jaded and before real life comes caving in, music really blows you away.
Absolutely.
And so something that you hear when you're young, it might not even be the best thing. There's records I have. I know they're not really good records,
yep.
really musically, but they still make me feel great because they blew me away because they hit me at the right age and the right time.
Yeah.
And that's what Wire did to a bunch of people.
Yeah. 100%. That's like when I listen, I still listen to Frail, and like the music's terrible, but the passion is there. And so I understand, you know, like the tunings even on the recordings weren't always on. And it was like, they didn't give a fuck. They're like, we're just doing this. You know, it was like a worse version of Born Against. But I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, like great band.
Right.
Seeing them live was always a pleasure. And I, you know, I got psyched, but yeah, man, I still listen to those. And again, that goes back to, it was so such an important ingredient was the passion and the heart that was being put into that music.
Yeah.
And I run into a lot of shit today, like where, well, it's cool because I do meet a lot of people that are interested in spirituality in whatever form. And even using that word for me is starting to become annoying because there's so much like stigma that comes along with it. But that, you know, grew up in that scene or love contemporary metal and are interested in things like mindfulness and meditation. And on the other hand, though, there's like the old school, quote unquote, spiritual people. And like, there's nothing spiritual about that. And I'm like, no, fuck you, man. Yes, there absolutely is. I look back. Yeah, like I look back to when I was, you know, now let's fast forward to like 16 and I'm getting into ISIS and Neurosis and, you know, that just cyclical, mantric kind of drone bands like High on Fire. And I didn't recognize it at the time, but that was taking me into a meditative, like deeply connected state. I just didn't have, you know, the wording, or I didn't know that's what it was because I had no interest in spirituality or whatever you care to call it. But now I look back and it's like, yeah, that was connecting me with something deeper within myself. So absolutely, it's spiritual and beautiful, and it still is to this day. Like, and that's why I still play like heavy music and listen to heavy music and many other genres, like I know you do as well. But yeah, man, who's to say what is or isn't? So you know, and that's part of like what I love about Dissolve. You were kind enough to send me you know, the new record that's coming out soon, and you know, that stayed with me, but I've listened to it at least like 50 times, and I fucking yeah, no exaggeration, dude, I love this record. Like it's amazing, and it just, it, you know, it's so great. It's completely Dissolve, but it's like, it's, it stays interesting. It's not one of those bands that just keeps putting records out, and it's like, it feels like they're phoning it in. Like you guys, like you were saying about like putting out the older stuff after Wire, it's like you felt like you weren't getting the attention or respect. But I love that progression of Dissolve, you know, like you, it shows how you grew and became more experimental, and both musically and vocally. And before we go further into that, I did want to read a couple of quotes.
Okay.
Because I always, when I hear people compliment me, I'm the worst at taking compliments. So I wanted to, you know, I don't know if you're like that, but for listeners, you know, that haven't heard of Dissolve, here's some things a few musicians have had to say. And in this genre, they're highly respected. So, quote, "You can't come from Poughkeepsie, New York, and not know the musical force that is Dissolve. They have been a solid presence in the hardcore scene since the early 90s, and they always, they will always be a blitz to the senses when they bring the heavy." And that was Matt Byrne, drummer from Hatebreed. And if you don't know who Hatebreed is, you know, like, your head is definitely up your ass. then we have Ken from Candiria, one of my all-time, you know, another favorite bands, one of just hearing them and the experimentation, and Ken's drumming is like second to none. But when I first saw Dissolve on stage, they were juxtaposing an intellectual and maniacal attitude that screamed true cerebral and outraged rebellion. The music was executed amazingly, too, with raw emotion and technical prowess. I was an immediate fan to this day, still get pumped by how they create the drive and their rhythmic perspective. Heavy metal has to drive rhythmically. Dissolve does it with a unique flair that has a perfect blend of quirky and crushing. That is absolutely true. Then you have Mike from Killswitch Engage, who is also in Overcast and other bands, but he says Dissolve will smash your face in with brutality. If you like the idea of glass shards shredding your eardrums apart, this is the band for you. That was pretty great. Jesse,
because who doesn't love glass shards in their ears? I mean,
I know I do. just a couple more. Jesse Leach, the singer of Killswitch Engage, who left for a while and Howard Jones filled in. Now he's back. Jesse said, Dissolve is a band that defies classification and genre. I've always loved the riffs and perfect chaos of the drums paired with the precision of the low end bass. As a vocalist, I've always been a fan of Paul's vicious and poetic approach to his voice and lyrics, easily one of the most eccentric and unpredictable frontmen to come out of the northeastern hardcore metal scene. They are masters of their craft in a band that for too long hasn't been given their due. Underrated and a sheer force to be reckoned with. Dissolve will tear your face off and then fold it into an abstract sculpture and hand it back to you with an eerie grin from ear to ear. And finally, Brian Fares, singer of Shadows Fall and, of course, Overcast and other bands. Dissolve were a band that was so far ahead of their time. No one was doing downtuned, sludgy riffs over driving grooves like these dudes were. There are riffs on their demo from decades ago that are still heavier than anything I've heard to date. They never cared about what was hip or trendy. They just wanted to make music that would pummel you into dust. So glad this rock and roll juggernaut is still rolling and crushing everything in their path. I agree with every single word every single one of those individuals said. So, you know, and those are big compliments. Like I said, I'm terrible at taking those. And I know they weren't all just about you, but Dissolve as a general. But, you know, hearing that, how does that make you feel? And, you know, do you agree with what they're saying? Do anything, you know, what does that bring up for you?
Oh, well, it's great. I really love all of those guys. We go back pretty far. I know that all of them have seen us play many times.
Yeah.
And I have the exact same amount of level of respect and love for them and their bands, too. Absolutely. Seriously.
Yeah.
We were very, very fortunate to come up around the time that we did, that we could play with all those guys when they were nobodies.
I know. Now look at them. When I was in Ground Zero, I was playing with like Mastodon and all these huge bands, now like Lamb of God. Yeah. And, you know, we're playing at the Bristol Skate Park on ramps to like 40, 50 people. And now look at them. So anyways.
I played the Crannell Street with Lamb of God, which is a really tiny part of the Chance Complex. And I never thought in a million years that they'd be, opening for Phil Slayer's last tour. Yeah, it's just insane.
It is.
But actually, it's funny you mentioned the Boiler Room. We met Overcast at the Boiler Room. We played a show with them sometime in 1993. And Jamie from Hatebreed booked the show, and Josta 14 was on the bill.
Wow,
I mean, we all go that far back. God, how old was Jamie then? I mean, he looked like a little boy.
He was.
He was a little boy. Yeah. It was weird, you know, but he was already a mover and a shaker. He was already kind of, I wouldn't say running things, but he was on his way.
Absolutely.
You know, no definitely. Even way back then. But as far as the things they said, I don't know what to say. It is hard to take compliments. You know, especially from people that you respect as much as I respect all of them.
Yeah.
But it means a lot. It really does. And as far as there's definitely, I think what I like about the things that they all said is that there's, I think from everybody, there's at least one sentence in there from each person that I'm like, it is very gratifying because they kind of understand what we're going for. Cause I'm like, yeah, that's what we're going for. Good. I'm glad that comes across.
Yes, I agree. When I read that in a book review, same thing. It's like, oh, thank you. Like, it's when you pour your heart and soul into something, you know, and people don't get it. It's, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, and so it's like, oh man, just like you're mentioning back to the Wire thing with the new Dissolve stuff. I when you say that, like, immediately that made me think of, you know, similar experiences I've had.
We've had to kind of develop a thick skin. Because we've always kind of wanted to go forward and do something a little bit different. All the time. And, you know, that's not celebrated in hardcore.
Yes.
I think people really generally, it's the kind of music where kind of predictability is supposed to be there. It's a, right. You know, and I respect that and I understand that, but yeah. I'm not going to fucking do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's not, I think the bands that I always really looked up to, and maybe they're actually bad role models, you know, but the ones that always just kind of went their own way.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, obviously, Black Flag is a big one. Black Flag will go out on tour and just play their new album.
Yeah.
You know, and a couple hits.
Yeah.
You know, like here and there or whatever. But pretty much they just went out there and, you know, people will be yelling out for Nervous Breakdown or something like that. And they just wouldn't play it. You know, right. They would just, you know, pull away. I wouldn't. And there was definitely a period of time where I think we were a little prickish, you know, where sure. We were kind of that way. We're like, you know, so we're not going to play any of we're not going to give you what you want, you know, and you know, that, and you know, that it's some, I think we found a happy medium over time where it was just like, where everybody could be happy, you know, yeah. We're like, okay, we'll play some of that. But I think, we've really had to, like I said, develop a thick skin, especially back then when we were trying different things, because, you know, people would kind of move on from us and then they'd come back. You know, and it's been a really long, twisted journey with this album, of where sometimes we're on top and sometimes we're not. You
sure.
Know, we play, and these days, even now, it's not a guaranteed thing. I think there was a period of time when we were doing reunion shows in the early 2000s or even mid 2000s that it was pretty much a sure thing. If we wanted to book a show, there'd be an audience there. It was pretty cool. But yeah. I kind of feel like once you make the announcement that you're back together and you're going to write new stuff, everyone's like, nah.
Yeah.
Like, nah, I'll pass. You know, I like the old records or whatever. So, you know, shows we play now, I mean, some of them are fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
And some of them are terrible. You know, we never really know. But the more I think about it, and the more and at first it's kind of disappointing because, like I said, that we were spoiled with those reunion shows, you know?
Oh, yeah. But I was at most of them, so I know. Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yep. You know, it was crazy. Yeah. But I think at the same time, the more I think about it, the more I'm kind of in it. I'm like, no, well, this is what it's like to be in a band. This is what it was like in the 90s.
Right.
Sometimes we played in front of 500 people. Sometimes we played in front of five.
Literally. You know? And driving like 5 hours for those five people, right?
Exactly.
Like, and getting paid gas money if you're lucky. Like,
yeah.
I know that struggle. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, you know, that's that it's really, and for some reason, really just in the past year or so, I've come to embrace that to where I'm like, yeah, this is kind of what it's, you know, this is what it's all about.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is really, and it really does kind of go back to spiritual journeys that people go on.
Yeah.
I think when you're young, you think that there's an answer and there's and you're going to find it and you're going to find it.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to seek and you're going to maybe you're going to take LSD and you're going to go like out in the woods and you're going to see if you can find the answer. Or maybe you're going to meditate and you're going to find the answer. Maybe you're going to get in touch with, you know, Krishna consciousness or the Roman Catholic Church, and you're going to find the answer, you know. But I think as you get older, you realize that there isn't really one true answer. It's kind of about the journey. It's about the answer is finding joy in the moment and finding joy in the small things and finding joy in everything that you do. So even if you're playing a show in front of five people, just think, it's like you're just so fortunate to be alive and to have created this music and to have these really great friends that you've had for like 35 years or whatever, and you're still doing it. It's like the most beautiful thing. And that is the answer. It's finding joy in that. And then if you're in front of like 500 people, well, then your fucking joy is 500 times that.
Paul, I've got to say, that's so beautifully said, man. Like, you know, I still do these two bands, one of which I'm fortunate to be doing with you that, you know, we're just getting off the ground, and another one that also is kind of just getting off the ground. But, you know, when music's instilled in you, you can't like not do it. It just I've taken breaks and for years, and it's like it just pulls me back no matter what. But, you know, so when I do the speaking thing and teach workshops, I will go still to this day. It's very interesting. I just got back from Phoenix speaking in front of like, I don't know, 700 people. A couple weeks before that, as in California, there was maybe 500. I've done 2,000, 1,000. And then I'll do workshops where there's like 5 or 10. And I am the same way. Like, I take that same approach. It's like, you know what? I am very, you know, this is how I make a living. This is what I get to do with my life. I get to show up and spend this time with these five people and have an intimate like workshop and help them on their healing journeys, which whether you know it or not, like your music and others have helped me on mine, you know, and just in different ways. There's so many integral ways to healing ourselves and getting through the day. But it's the same deal. Like, the only difference for me is I say like it gets lonely because I don't have those friends like you mentioned. Like, it's just like touring, same thing. I'm touring, but it's right. me alone. If I'm lucky, I get to like bring my fiance to an event, but you know, that's few and far between. So, you know, I spend a lot of time in the hotel by myself, whatever. But there's just the gratitude aspect. So I really appreciate you shining a light on that and dig hearing that even after all these years, like that's how you're feeling about it. Super cool.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. Super glad like Dissolve has went that route. Cause you look at bands like, you're right. It can be a very like closed minded, scene in the hardcore scene. Yeah. I remember like when Cave-In and Converge and Neurosis and right. Norma Jean, they all started to kind of progress and go their own way. And either people stuck with them or they were like, fuck those guys. You know, their first two records were good and the rest I don't care about. Converge's right. last record, man. Oh my God. Like, for me at least, absolutely phenomenal. I'll still listen to it.
I love that last Converge.
Yeah. Yeah.
That song, what's that song on there? I think it's called In Duress.
See, I'm the worst with song titles.
Oh, that's like the heaviest shit they ever did. Yeah. I mean, it really holds up. It really yes. does. And their whole thing. Converge is an interesting band because in the 90s I was very I was very frustrated with them because mm-hmm. I always kind of felt like I thought they were a good band.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they were a little bit different than everybody else. But I also kind of felt like they were just, I don't know. They were trying to find themselves really. And yeah. they were trying on all these different hats. You know, I remember they did that Steve Austin record.
Yeah.
And I thought they kind of sounded a little like Today's the Day on it, you know, mm. a little bit like here and there. And they were always doing these. So I'd always be kind of frustrated. And I was always like, God, guys, just fucking be yourself, you know, just do that. And then they came out with Jane Doe and I was like, they did it.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah.
They fucking found it. They yep. found who they are. And I've loved every record since then. Like Absolutely. they really did it, you know, and it took them a while to find it. And then when they got that sound and when Kurt, I mean, that was really, I know Kurt had recorded them before and had done a bunch of recording, but that was the first Kurt recording, I think.
Right.
Like the way, like everything after that now sounds like that level. That yes. was the first one that you're just like, I remember thinking, hearing that record and that it didn't even really sound like, it didn't sound like a, you know, like I didn't pay attention to the guitar or the drums or there was nothing dominant. It was just like one big brick being thrown at you, yeah. you know?
No, that's a great way of saying it. And look at yeah. now, you've got Kurt fucking winning, or High on Fire winning a Grammy for their last record that Kurt recorded. Like, and
yeah.
See them on that stage and to hear Kurt's name, I recorded in Kurt's at God City way back. Like,
oh, really?
We played with his band, I think it was the Huguenots, like one of his old bands. He was still in Converge, but he had a side project. So, you know, I don't know Kurt, like back in the day when I was in Ground Zero, we played with him a lot. But, you know, they're one of those bands that just, you're right, they found their sound. I still do like that, like Petitioning the Empty Sky stuff. Because, again, yeah. I was a teenager. It was connecting. Right. But yeah, Jane Doe, You Failed Me. Like all this stuff after that was just like, man, like, all right.
Yeah, all of it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really play with them. I don't think we hardly ever played with them, which is kind of odd.
Weird. Yeah.
I mean, considering that I think we would have fit together. Completely. I mean, I don't know how much we fit perfectly with anybody, but I mean, we played with a lot of bands that they played with. So I don't know. It was just kind of like a weird luck that we didn't. But I'll tell you what, we did play a show with them once, and it was back in, it was in, I think, 93 or 94, whenever that comp came out, the one we were just talking about.
Oh,
the
Endless Fight?
The Endless Fight one.
Yeah, because they were on it. I still love that song, too. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the like the CD release for that show. And we put, and every band, I think anybody who could make it. I think some bands were from pretty far away that didn't make it, but who could make it played.
I was there. That was the LNG.
Oh, you were there.
In New London at the LNG. Yeah.
No. There was at some weird
It was
like the back of like a skate shop or a bike shop or something, but it was like the back room of a place. It was very small.
Old Sabre? It was in Connecticut, right?
Yeah, it was in Connecticut. If there's anybody out there that could shed some light on this, where was that release show? But it was a weird little place. I remember everybody played on the floor, and it was really very haphazard, very DIY.
I was there. Yeah. I'm sorry, but go on. Yes.
But it was but Converge played, and I think they were like literally 13 years old. I mean, and it's funny because like that's always been, that's kind of the running gag with Dissolve. It's just like, you know, when you were 12 or 13, I was a man already. I think I was at that point, I was like 21 or something. You know what I mean? And these guys were, they look like children.
Yeah.
But they were so endearing. I remember watching them play, and I wasn't a huge fan, you know, but I watched them play because I was like, like you're saying before, it's like they were, like we've been talking about, they had that intangible thing. They had that passion, you know, where they were. And, I knew there were people to watch. But once again, I had no idea that all these years later, they'd be the guys on top and that they were going to be as good as they got. So you got to watch the quiet ones. Yeah. You got to watch the weird little kid.
You never know. And yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody listening, please hit me up because I know I was there. What I'm confusing is I think his name was Josh, who did the Endless Fight.
Yes.
Stuff, and he did two comps, and he did actually a few shows for that first one, and one of them was at the LNG. And I remember Frostbite was at that one, and I don't think they were at the one you're talking about. I could be wrong.
I believe you're correct. Yeah.
But I remember I was definitely at both of them, so that's why I immediately went to the LNG. But there's been a lot of those little pop-up, like one-off or, you know, lasted a month or two venues where we'd have shows, and the place all of a sudden, you know, it would just get trashed, and they'd be like,
oh,
no, we're here. So.
Yeah, lots of places. There was a place in New Haven called the Fun House. Do you remember that?
No, I don't think I made it.
Yeah. That was, I think there was maybe one or two shows there. It was so close to the Tune-In. It was on like the other side of, what's that big field there in the middle of New Haven?
I think it's like, just the New Haven Green, it's called.
Yeah, the Green. Yeah. It was like on the other side of the Green, you know. Yeah. But we played a lot of those little places in Connecticut that lasted like 2 seconds, you know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned the Boiler Room. I'm glad that we managed to get there for a couple of shows. We played our very first show in Connecticut at Boiler Room, and it was funny because it was probably like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a really hot day, and I think there was like maybe only like five people watching us. One of them was Boulder. Love that guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And Jamie Josta, I think maybe, was it Greg from Josta 14?
Mm-hmm.
There were like a few, like really not many people, but it was like from that show, those guys bought demos. And the next time we came back, like all those dudes knew the lyrics and shit.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really awesome. It was really great. And, the Boiler Room, it will always have very warm memories for that place. Well, once again, that's a pun because that place was disgustingly hot.
Yes, it was. Yeah. The name was so fitting.
Yeah. The name was really fitting. It was horrible in there, you know, but it was a good time. It was, I met Overcast there, met Jamie, you know, a lot of people that went on to be pretty important to me. So,
I'm glad to hear that.
Go Connecticut, man.
Yeah, man, we've done some okay things for a small state, you know. I only got to see two shows there before they changed it or tore it down. I don't remember what happened to it, but, you know, at least I got to see two shows. Dissolve, unfortunately, was not one of them, but, at least I made it. You know, I didn't make the Anthrax. I made the Boiler Room. But
there you go.
So we got a few minutes left. I have two questions. Three, technically. One of them's a two-part, and then we'll end up on the last one. But I I like to, you know, especially with musicians, I love stories, and this can be brief because we, again, don't have much time, but I would love if, and this can be the first thing that comes to mind, if you can tell me, this is a two-parter. First of all, what is one of the most frightening experiences you've ever had while performing? If such, maybe there's been tons of them. And then on the flip side, what's one of the most enjoyable experiences you've had while performing? So I'm speaking specifically to, like, while on stage, not recording, not touring, but like actually performing.
Well, there was one show. It was in Connecticut. I won't tell you what town. Sure. There was, I think they were, we were playing, I got really caught up in the moment, and they turned the PA off on us, because I guess they, you know, they deemed us done.
Yeah.
And we just kept playing anyway, like, and because I didn't have a live mic, I took my clothes off. So there was, like, you know, everyone's looking at you, that, you know, you're supposed to do something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't get completely naked or anything, but my, you know, my ass was hanging out and stuff like that. So, yeah. A guy, like, from the place, like, ran up to me and, like, grabbed me by the leg and was just like, "You put your fucking clothes on now." Yeah. And I was like, so I did. And then that guy, and this was at some, like, rec center, you know, yeah, at, like, pretty upscale Connecticut town. So
I know exactly where you're talking about. And we'll leave it at that, because I've played there. Yeah, I know where you're talking about.
But the guy, like, pulled me aside and was screaming at me, you know, about, you know, what had happened. And he said he was going to call the cops. So I went out. So I was like, all right, well, I don't really want to go to jail. So I know our drummer at the time, like, he took his own car. So I remember, like, I got in the car and I put my hoodie on, like, over my head, and he drove me past the police that had showed up.
Wow.
And we left and everything. Statute of limitations, people. That's all I'm talking about. This was a very long time ago. So I get home and I realize that I don't have my backpack, and I'd left it there, and it had, like, all my lyrics, everything that I wanted. So I had to go back, like, a couple days later and get my backpack from the dude who called the cops on me. I mean, it just goes to show how much balls I had.
Yeah.
But when I walked in, and I was pretty terrified. I thought for sure, like, when I saw those cops, they're looking at me, I'm, like, looking at the floor.
Yeah, right.
So I got out of there. It was fine. And, but when the guy saw me, he just like smiled and looked down and shook his head and pulled out the backpack and just handed it to me. And
I was like, all right. Cool.
So it was fine. And he was like, "Don't you ever pull no shit like that again." And I was like, "Don't worry, we'll never, ever come back here."
Yeah.
You're rid of me forever, you know, and I'm glad everything ended up. As far as, like, truly, truly terrifying, you know, we always avoided any kind of hardcore conflict. We were never really affiliated with anything violent or anything. So I was never really, I mean, I would say, as a spectator, I've been at shows that were terrifying.
Yeah.
But we never really played one that where a scary thing happened. And I'm very, very fortunate for that. So yeah. And as far as most enjoyable, there were many, many. I'm just going to single maybe one. I'm going to single out two. One was the first show we ever played, but I've already touched upon that.
Yeah.
Definitely one of the most enjoyable shows we ever played was the first time that we played the New England Metal Fest.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Up in Worcester.
I think it was maybe 99 or 2000.
Yeah.
You know, I think we were just about to record the Caveman record. We had a bunch of really strong songs, and we had a really good set list of, like, old and new songs, and just the feeling in the room, you know. I think we had kind of fallen out of favor for a little while.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a show that kind of put us back. Like, yeah, wow, people are still there for us. You know, There was just a feeling of love in the room was really, really great that day. And I'll always really look back. And it's funny because I posted, I think, a photo from that on the Dissolve Instagram. And a lot of other people kind of chimed in saying the same thing, that was a very enjoyable show, you know, for us, you know, and for everybody. And really, I mean, I can't remember all the bands that played, but before, it was an exciting time for heavy music. I mean, a lot of bands that became very big, very shortly after played that show. So yeah. It was, you know, it was really neat that we were all kind of on that same level at the time before things got super huge, you yeah. know, for everybody else but us.
You
know,
well, you and Cable, you're the two bands. It never made sense to me that, like, it didn't get bigger. And everyone always says, like, you know, it's Dissolve and then Cable. Like, they were ahead of their time. They were genre breakers. And they just, I know with Cable, it was like, because they would put a record out, they wouldn't tour, or they would, and then they'd break up yeah. and whatever. But, you know, two bands that slipped by. But, you know, the new record's coming out, which I can't, honestly, like I said, I've had it for, what, not even 2 weeks and listened to it like 50 times. And I am not exaggerating. It's phenomenal. Thank you, man. I'm so jazzed on it. It's been so hard to like keep it to myself because I want everybody to hear it, but
so do I.
They're not going to be disappointed, I am sure of that. So that leads me to my final question is,
sure,
here we are, man, 2019 going on 2020. You're a parent now. You're still, you know, you have a job. We all do, like all of us hardcore kids that are still alive, because we've lost a lot of really good people. Those of us that are still here, man, like, you know, many of us are still playing music, but we're working and trying to juggle our passion. And I'm not a parent, but, you know, most of my friends are, most of the people I'm in bands with are. And so, you know, just tell me briefly about your life now. Like, you know, the Dissolve record's coming out. It's great. But, you know, you have a job, you have kids, and it's a lot different than 93 when the demo was coming out. So, you know, if you can tell me, just kind of compare and contrast where today is at and what your life today is like for you.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I have two kids. I have a boy and a girl. Yeah. Boy is 7, girl is 12. You know, I have a house, that I share here with my wife, who I love very much. We've been together for 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I go to work every day. My work is a really good mix of, you know, red tape bullshit and really, really deeply meaningful stuff.
That's awesome.
because I work in a group home, the manager of a group home for people with developmental disabilities. So
incredible, man.
Yeah, so it can be, you know, but the thing that's really challenging is all of the things that you have to deal with, you know, things like ledgers and things that are due and, you know, all that. But, you know, the enjoyable things are when you actually make a difference in somebody's day,
yes,
you know. So there's a little bit of that. But other than that, yeah, but I try, as far as like the way music fits into it, it's different. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, when I was single and back in the 90s, I would bring a notebook to Dunkin' Donuts in the middle of the night and try to write lyrics and stuff. And, you know, I just kind of like lived it, you know, that was it. And like my job just, you know, like, you know, I just had a job. I'd be a janitor. I'd be at Taco Bell or, you know, whatever. Because music was, you know, all of it. Now it's all reversed.
Yeah.
Now the music is whenever I can get to it, whenever I can do it.
Right.
And it's funny because I feel like a lot of times, when we're a little bit inactive, real life thinking starts to come into it. And I'm like, why am I doing it at all? Like,
right.
it really doesn't make any sense at all. It's not like I'm going out and I'm making lots of money. It's not like I'm going out and I don't feel like we're making a huge difference in the world.
Yeah.
But then when we go out and finally do it, like play a show or have a practice or write a song or something like that, I mean, there it is. That's the reason. You know, it's just this, it's simple. It's very, I don't know. As life gets more complicated, the things that you kind of crave, the things that are just that simple.
I love,
you know,
that.
Just, you know, that are just, you know, all us getting together, having a nice chat, playing some music, and hopefully making people happy. Making people happy has always been my goal. I don't, you know, a lot of people think this music is very negative, you know, whatever.
Right.
I want everybody to smile. I want everybody to have a good time. I want everybody to pat each other on the back and just, you know, and I want everybody to be able to enjoy it. I don't want one big meathead guy moshing and hurting all the girls. I want everybody up front having a good time.
Yeah.
That's always kind of been our vibe, you know,
right,
forever. So, yeah, I mean, and I think I really try. I mean, I struggle sometimes, you know, I suffer from the same kind of frustrations and anxieties and anger that everybody does. But I think I try to raise my children, you know, in a way that, I don't know, that maybe they'll feel the same way, you know, that they'll feel like, you know, just those, you know, those simple things in life are really what it's all about, that are the most meaningful, you know, it's funny. People like, you know, my wife is a teacher and I do what I do, you know, we're never, ever going to be rich.
Right. Yeah.
You know, as far as money goes, but as I get older, that matters less and less to me. You know, I mean, I think there was a time where I'm like, oh shit, I'm starting to get old. I better start figuring this stuff out. And I think we've kind of got to a place to where we maintain a good life without fucking anybody over.
Yeah.
And if people, if more people did that, that would be nice. You know, I don't know. That's, I don't know. But unfortunately, our world isn't really looking like it's very interested in moving that way.
No. Which I know you, you addressed that in your first song, Decimator, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can't wait for people to hear that. Actually, there's some, I think even you've posted some videos of that on, or Dissolve has, but on my YouTube page, so it's out there. But yeah, man, I mean, well, thank you, Paul, for kind of like going down memory lane with me, bringing us up to speed. I hate, like, this is the times where I hate that the show has a time limit, and obviously we're over on that, but it is what it is, because we could talk for hours.
We could, yeah.
But being a parent, I know you've got to get your kids, and, you know, we got to bring this to a close, but I love the fact that it just means I'm going to have you back on and revisit.
Anytime. Yeah, anytime.
We'll talk after the album comes out, see how that's going. But one thing I did want to say, man, is that the music, it does. Like, at least for me, and I'm sure I'm speaking on other people's behalf, like when you're saying, like, why am I doing this? Like, you know, because I question that too. It's time consuming. It's also cathartic and part of my, like, healing process. And I write dark things as well, but they actually are in a, have a positive, you know, intention behind them. But with the Dissolve music, the new record, like, it really is helpful to me. And so for whatever that's worth, and I'm sure it will be to other people, you know, if you find yourself questioning that, like I know I do with my books and my music, you know, it helps when I hear people say, thank you, this helped or that helped. And this new Dissolve record, as well as the old stuff ever since the 90s, it's been like a big integral part of the soundtrack to my life. So, you know, I thank you. I thank the rest of the band for that. And the last thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, I know you guys have a Bandcamp page where I think like basically everything is available there, if I'm not mistaken, like the Wire, not Wire demo, the demo 93 with Wire, Dismantle, like it's all up on there, correct?
It is. Yep. And, yep. Everything is there. Yep.
And what's the link to that, if you know by chance?
I don't really know, but I do think that we're like, it's like Dissolve 2. Like the number 2.
Okay.
I think, you know, because believe it or not, there's other bands called Dissolve. I mean, you really think a name like Dissolve, it's so unbelievably original, you know, that nobody would have it, you know, but there are many apparently. Yes. Yeah. And you know, some of them are pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I've always kind of dreamed of having like a Dissolve show where it's just like, where it's all the Dissolves, you know,
that would
like that. Yeah. But I don't know how we'd be able to do it. One's from Italy, one's from Russia, one's from England. So, you know, but I believe it's Dissolve too. You'll know. I think you'll be able to figure it out. I mean, we probably have the most stuff.
Yeah.
And there's like a little bio, you know. Yeah. So if you did a search for Dissolve and you see a bunch of guys that look old in the picture, that's us.
Well, here's the nice thing about being on the Be Here Now Network is there are some wonderful folks that work on these podcasts and do show recaps and notes. So listeners, by the time this airs, you're simply going to be able to scroll down in this link that we are not exactly sure the address of. I know it exists because I was just looking at it the other day.
It's so rad too.
Yes, one of those lovely people at the Be Here Now Network will be kind enough to find it, and you'll scroll down and find the link to it, so you can simply click on that, and that will bring you to Dissolve's Bandcamp page, where you can hear the evolution of their music. You can just hear the incredible just beast that Dissolve is. And lastly, Paul, the new record called Until the Drugs Wear Off, I know you've been waiting on an exact date. Are you still waiting on that date? Is there a tentative timeline that you're hoping for, or Still not sure.
Well, I think from what I've heard, it's going to be like about 4 to 6 weeks after we get the test pressing. We haven't got the test pressing yet.
Okay.
So I'm hoping maybe November.
Cool.
You know, maybe. Yeah, something like that. So that's yeah.
Well, that'll tie in great with this because there's a few episodes in queue before you. So this will probably be airing right around that time. So,
well, great.
Paul, thank you, man, for on a personal level and just on a everyday level. Thanks for being a good fucking human being, being in an incredible band, and taking the time to have this conversation with me. It's much appreciated.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
All right.